This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Encouraging results from an early stage test of a coronavirus vaccine.
I think this is getting to first base of a journey to get a home run.
And other signs of progress. Movie theaters in China are open again. Today's blockbuster in Shanghai may surprise you.
It's not a documentary, but it feels like it. It's a very beautifully shot movie about three Uyghur children.
Also ahead, U.S. immigration judges are walking off the job, fed up with imposed quotas.
Recalculating the court into an essentially an assembly line justice.
And could you tell the difference between the real thing and a robot?
Well, I'm not sure how much time you've spent in the water with real dolphins.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. A glimmer of hope in the fight against the coronavirus today. Scientists at Oxford University published the results of an early phase vaccine experiment. The journal The Lancet reviewed and published the research. Richard Horton is an editor there.
I think these results are extremely encouraging, and I'm very optimistic. It's right that we now have to go into what we call phase three studies. That's to say studies where people are exposed to the virus, where there's virus still being transmitted in communities. And we need to know that this vaccine can actually prevent infection in those populations. But this news today should give us cause for encouragement.
Richard, the whole race for the vaccine can get complicated, and it feels like last week we heard about a different test for a different vaccine. What did we learn last week, and what does this new information add to what we know about what kind of vaccine will work?
Well, right now we have something like 200 different vaccine candidates under development around the world, and around 20 of those are actually in human clinical trials now. So what we're doing is we're spreading our options. There are different types of vaccines with different designs, different ways of eliciting an immune response. And this is good to have diversity because not every one of these is going to be successful. So the more options that we've got in vaccine candidates, the more likely it is we're going to get a vaccine in the next 12 months.
Are the results of this first experiment, does it mean that this is the beginning of the end of this pandemic?
I don't think we have enough to say that this is the beginning of the end. I think this is getting to first base of a journey to get a home run on this quest for a vaccine. We still have phase three studies to go. We still have to prove that it is absolutely safe when given to human beings over the long term. So there's many more steps that we need to fulfill. But the first step is extremely positive.
Now, you keep mentioning phase three as being vitally important. What happens in phase three? Why is it so important?
In a phase three clinical trial, what you're hoping to show is a significant difference between the two groups, obviously, whereby those who received the Oxford vaccine have a much less risk of infection than those who received the control vaccine. So that's what we're hoping for. And those trials are already ongoing in Brazil, in South Africa, and in the United Kingdom. And we hope to get a result later this year.
And if you get a good result from phase three, is all systems go? You start distributing the vaccine?
Absolutely. If we get a good result from phase three, then we are in a pole position to start producing the vaccine worldwide and making sure that those who are at greatest risk of this infection get the vaccine first. Those are people who are older, people who have chronic illness, health workers, and people from Black and minority ethnic communities. And if we can get the virus ramped up and to those individuals as soon as possible, then we're in a good place to prevent any further damage from this pandemic.
Richard Horton is an editor at The Lancet, where the Oxford vaccine trial results were published and reviewed. Thanks very much, Richard.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
The so-called drug war in Mexico has been raging for well over a decade. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Many of those assumed to be dead simply went missing, never to be seen again by family or friends. Now, as the world's Jorge Valencia reports, the Mexican government is reporting a grim new figure on the number of people who've disappeared.
Mexico's government has a team dedicated to looking for missing people. It's called the National Search Commission. And last week, they released a staggering figure. More than 71,000 people have gone missing since violence related to drug trafficking scaled up about 14 years ago.
Soy Marta Leticia García, representante del colectivo Entre Cielo y Tierra.
Marta Leticia García is with a group of women in the city of Guadalajara who are looking for missing relatives. They staged a demonstration outside of their local government forensics lab after the National Search Commission released its new findings.
Queremos que por favor salgan a buscar a nuestros hijos.
We want them to please go looking for our children, García says. She and other mothers spoke to a local news website called Sonadox.
Mi hijo es Cristian Alexander Valencia Ruiz.
Another woman wearing a face mask says she's looking for her son, Cristian Alexander Valencia Ruiz. She says Cristian went missing on New Year's Eve, and that when her brother went looking for Cristian 3 days later, he went missing too. Other women stood by holding large photos of their missing sons and grandsons. There are dozens of groups like theirs across Mexico.
Yeah, that's symptomatic of the generalized nature of the problem.
Alejandro Anaya is a professor of international relations and human rights at ITESO University in Guadalajara. He says the Mexican government's newest number on missing persons is consistent with the country's reality, a sophisticated society functioning parallel to stark inequality and an ongoing armed conflict. Anaya says that's why groups of relatives all over the country plea publicly for authorities to find their missing loved ones or go looking for them themselves.
So authorities don't find persons. They don't even do a very good job looking for them. The ones who actually are doing the job are the family members, mostly mothers.
The Mexican government's numbers, Anaya says, reveals the two groups that are the most frequently targeted, young men and young women and girls.
So that suggests strongly that this is related to the illicit sexual slavery of women. And then regarding men, it's basically young adults, we could say at an active age in criminal organizations.
Although many don't have any direct link with organized crime. 6 years ago, 43 university students went missing one night in a small city in southeastern Mexico. Theirs has become the most emblematic case of missing persons. Alive you took them, and alive we want them. So goes a chant that has been repeated in countless demonstrations since the 43 students from the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College went missing. When President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was elected 2 years ago, he said finding the students was his priority. Here's Professor Alejandro Anaya again.
Many NGOs actually complain that the government only cares about the Ayotzinapa case and it doesn't care about the other 70,000 cases.
And yet the biggest breakthrough in the missing students case came only this month when investigators said they found the remains of one student. There have been no convictions. Efraín Suk is with the investigative journalism group Quinto Elemento Lab. His team maintains a map that identifies hidden graves across the country where missing persons are likely buried. He says Mexico's National Search Commission hasn't elaborated on discrepancies between different reports they've issued.
Tampoco se publicó una metodología.
Suk explains the government also hasn't fully released details about how they collect their information. So he's concerned there may still be people who are unaccounted for.
Digamos que más allá de una opinión, un poco lo que la evidencia señala es justo que
Suk says this is evidence that there's still a lack of accountability from the government. So he says that even reports like this one aren't enough for Mexico's culture of violence to change and for the disappearances to stop. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Mexicans top the list of nationalities waiting to go through U.S. immigration courts. The number of judges available to hear cases has long been thin and is now getting even thinner. A record 35 immigration judges have left the bench in the past year, some resigning and some retiring. Turnover is the highest since record-keeping began in 1997. Judge Ashley Tabador is the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She joins us from Los Angeles. Judge Tabador, the immigration system in this country involves a lot of waiting, and the data shows that immigration judges have more cases than ever on their docket. Is the huge backlog of cases playing a role in judges leaving?
Yes, the backlog of cases is a factor in many of the judges' decision to leave the bench. I think what most people don't fully appreciate, however, is that our immigration court system and immigration judges are not traditional judges and courts. Our immigration court system is situated within a law enforcement agency, the Department of Justice, and judges are hired and fired by our chief federal prosecutor, the U.S. Attorney General. So the situation and the pressures of being an immigration judge in a law enforcement agency is quite different than being a traditional judge in a traditional court. And that's why what you have seen, particularly in the last few years, is an implementation of law enforcement policy-oriented tools, making sure that the court is in line with the executive branch's law enforcement priorities. And those pressures have played a great degree of influence in the judges who've been on the bench for a long time to leave, as well as many of those who were hired recently and came to realize this is really not what they had signed up for.
Are you implying that immigration judges should be under a different part of government and not in law enforcement? Or are you suggesting just that the culture and priorities of this administration make it more of a law enforcement role?
Both. Definitely the long-term solution and one that we have been advocating for many, many years is that you cannot really have a court system and a judicial system that's controlled by a law enforcement agency and a prosecutor. And we've seen issues plaguing the court basically from its inception in 1983 in different degrees. But the last few years has been the most interference we have ever seen. Unprecedented micromanagement, as well as recalculating the court into essentially an assembly line justice. Introduction of quotas and deadlines was the first time that we have ever had to deal with assessment of a judge's performance based on quantity rather than quality. Judges should not be assessed based on the number of cases they churn out, but rather based on the quality of the decisions that they issue. That's what we've seen in the last 3 years, is just an emphasis on numbers and interfering in the judge's ability to be able to control their docket and make decisions based solely on the facts, the evidence, and the law.
Give us an example. How does running it more like an assembly line affect the judgments and decisions immigration judges are making?
So we now have 8 different numeric metrics upon which we are judged. One of those is case completion quotas. Every judge, regardless of the type of docket, which means regardless of the type of cases that they're handling, is expected to complete 700 cases a year. For certain judges, that's not a problem. We have some judges who are able to complete well over 1,000, some of them close to 2,000, because of the nature of the cases they get. Other judges cannot be expected to reasonably complete even 200 or 300 cases a year because they're dealing with very old cases or very complex cases. So trying to turn everything into one size fits all introduces an external factor into the judge's decision-making authority.
If experienced judges are leaving the bench, what kind of impact is that having on the U.S. immigration system?
Well, that's going to have a tremendous impact because those judges have a lot more institutional knowledge. They have a good sense of what the cases are likely going to look like 2 or 3 years down the line. Right now, particularly the new judges, those who have not had much experience in immigration law and have not been on the bench, do not really have that experience of knowing that, okay, the administration now is telling you to do certain things, but are those things really going to withstand scrutiny when you go through the appellate process? So you're going to see a lot of inefficiencies that are going to show themselves 2, 3, 4 years down the line.
Judge Ashley Tabador is the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's been more than a year since the downfall of the Islamic State in Iraq, and investigators are still trying to document and piece together the atrocities committed there. Now that the caliphate is no longer, one group has made it its mission to collect, document, and preserve evidence of ISIS crimes. And a word of warning, some details in our next story might be difficult for some listeners. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
ISIS carried out one of its worst mass atrocities at a military base in northern Iraq. Camp Spiker was named after an American Navy pilot who died in the Gulf War. In 2014, the Iraqi military used the camp for training. Ali Hussein Qadem got there in the spring. He was a baby-faced 23-year-old recruit. At the camp, he says, soldiers were mostly cut off from the outside world. They were busy training every day. But by summer, word got out that ISIS was taking over cities in northern Iraq. By the time Qadem and his fellow soldiers found out they were in danger, it was too late. On June 12, ISIS militants captured Qadem and thousands of other Iraqi troops. They divided them up into smaller groups, tied their hands behind their backs, and loaded them onto trucks. Qadem's group was taken to the former presidential palace of Saddam Hussein. He says he remembers vividly how the ISIS gunmen ordered everyone to lie down right next to each other, like sardines. Then he says the shooting started. Qadem thought about his wife and their two children back home. But Qadem was lucky that day. He says bullets whizzed right past his head and missed. Qadem says he could barely breathe. After the sun went down, he got up and escaped on foot. As far as he knows, he's the only survivor of the group. What happened that day came to be known as the Camp Spiker Massacre. The United Nations says ISIS captured and murdered at least 1,700 Iraqi soldiers. In 2017, the Iraqi government asked the international community to help document and investigate crimes of the Islamic State, or Daesh as it's known in Arabic. The UN Security Council set up a special investigative team for that purpose. It's known as UNITAD.
There's no community that refused to bow its head to Daesh that was let off. They were targeted and they suffered enormously.
Karim Ahmad Khan is the head of UNITAD. He says the first question his team had to answer was which ISIS crimes should they focus on? For example, there are more than 200 mass graves discovered in former ISIS territory. Khan says they had to narrow down their focus.
We will devote attention on three investigative areas originally, which is Sinjar, Mosul, and the massacre at Tikrit Air Cadet Academy,
also known as Camp Spiker. Khan's team has met with Ali Hussein Qadem, the man who survived the massacre. They've also talked to other survivors and relatives of victims. The investigators are documenting their stories and collecting photos, videos, anything that could help bring those responsible to justice. Many ISIS fighters have died on the battlefield, but others are still in prisons in Iraq and Syria. Khan says his team has already helped bring evidence of ISIS crimes to courts in Europe and Iraq.
So the work is going well, but it must be viewed relative to the amount of criminality that confronts us in relation to Daesh.
More recently, though, the investigators have had to adjust to a new hurdle, the coronavirus pandemic. Khan says they're not meeting anyone in person, and instead they've rolled out an app that survivors can use to submit evidence.
Whether they're in Iraq, whether they're in Australia, whether they're in Germany or elsewhere, that will allow those witnesses to give us their details, to tell us briefly what happened to them, to upload any photographs or any information they may have seized as they fled or were released from their locations.
In 2016, the Iraqi government hanged 36 ISIS members convicted of taking part in the Camp Spiker massacre. Bahan, who has worked on cases connected to other mass atrocities, says it will take time to fully investigate these crimes. As for Ali Hussein Kadhim, he's now working for a religious organization in Iraq. He says he's struggling to make ends meet. When I ask him what justice would look like for him, he says all of the ISIS fighters responsible for killing Iraqi soldiers should face the death penalty in public. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And before we take a break, this European caper caught our eye. If there's one thing you can say about drug traffickers, they're creative. Drug runners have recently hidden cocaine in limes, pineapples, even rocks. And now, inside of hollowed-out coffee beans. Italian police found a package of about 500 coffee beans coming from Medellin, Colombia. Each bean stuffed with cocaine and carefully wrapped in brown tape. Talk about coffee that will make you jittery. It wasn't a huge bust in size, about 130 grams of cocaine or about a quarter pound, but a big bust in bravado. Investigators were tipped off at Milan's Malpensa airport when they noticed the coffee shipment addressed to Santino D'Antonio. Fans of action movies might recognize that name.
If you don't do this, you know the consequences.
Santino D'Antonio is the crime boss in the film John Wick, Chapter 2, starring Keanu Reeves. In real life, the man posing as D'Antonio was a 50-year-old Italian trying to collect the cocaine-filled coffee beans in Florence. Next time, stick to decaf. You might start each morning off with a cup of coffee, and you can make the world part of your morning routine, too. Subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Top of the World, to get the latest headlines right in your inbox. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. That's theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. Germany addressed the Holocaust through reparations, monuments, museums, and school curricula. A German-born scholar in the U.S. says it's time for America to do the same.
I definitely think there should be a memorial for slavery in the capital. There is a Holocaust memorial in Washington, D.C., but not a slavery memorial.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. There's nothing like talking about money to get tempers frayed. For 4 days now, the leaders of Europe's 27 nations have been locking horns over a coronavirus recovery package. The talks were scheduled for 2 days, but stark differences emerged between what wealthy countries in Northern Europe, like the Netherlands and Sweden, want and what their southern neighbors, like Spain and Italy, are hoping to get. The World's Orla Barry is in London. Orla, first of all, what is on the table?
Well, what was on the table when the talk started, Carol, was a total fund of 750 billion euro. And the initial suggestion proposed by France and Germany was that most of the money, 500 billion euro of it, would be dished out to countries in the form of grants and would be given to the member states most badly hit by the pandemic. And that would have been, as you say, places like Spain and Italy. Italy, they've notably high death rates from the virus, although all of Europe has been obviously badly hit.
So what happened?
Well, what happened is, as expected, Mark Rutte, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, along with Austria, Sweden and Denmark, they are known as the Frugal Four. In fact, in the last 24, 48 hours, they're now the Frugal Five because Finland has joined them. They all disputed distributing the money in this way. They don't want to see the money being given as grants. They want to see it distributed as loans. But also, more significantly, they want the money to be conditional. They want to see that the money is tied in some way to an agreement by those countries that they introduce a series of reforms, whether those reforms be in the form of pension plans, the labour market, climate change, etc. Here's Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, speaking at the start of the conference about how he wanted to see it all played out.
If the South is needing help from other countries in terms to cope with the crisis, I think it is only reasonable for us to ask for a clear commitment to reforms. And there is a reason for all of this. And that is the fact that we need a strong Europe in an unstable world.
Wow. So how did those talks go? I mean, they started up again today, which indicates they didn't get that far.
No, they didn't. As you said, they were scheduled to last only 2 days. They continued for 4 days. They finished up at 5:30 a.m. this morning. They've been described as the most acrimonious discussions between EU leaders in years. At one point, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, slammed the table and threatened to walk out. The Italian Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, said that the European members were being blackmailed by the frugals, those frugal 4 to 5 countries in Northern Europe. So tempers got really frayed. But what you have to remember is what is at stake here. It isn't just about the money. It is, in a sense, about the future of the structure of the European Monetary Union as we know it. Have a listen to Guntram Wolf. He's director of the European economics think tank Bruegel.
I mean, this is really something that will change the way the European Union works quite significantly, because we move away from a budget process to a system where countries receive grants that from money that is being borrowed by the EU institutions. And that has lots of implications. And that's why it's so difficult to actually come to a deal.
And as I understand it, it's not just disagreements between the rich northern EU countries and their poorer southern neighbours that's been happening here.
No, there is another factor to this. One of the proposals on the table, and one that Mark Rutte of the Netherlands has been pushing for, is that countries who are not seen to respect the rule of law have their funding cut. And for years, some EU countries have been trying to introduce measures to get EU members to respect basic laws like media freedom and an independent judiciary. And one country, as you know, in particular, that has been flouting these laws for some years now is Hungary under Viktor Orban. Poland also has been carving a rather similar path. Viktor Orban believes this is all very personal against him. This was him talking at the summit yesterday.
I don't know what is the personal reason for the Dutch Prime Minister to hate me or Hungary, but he is attacking so harshly and making very clear that because Hungary, in his opinion, does not respect the rule of law, must be punished financially. That's his position, which is not acceptable.
Wow. Really shows the kind of fragility of the EU. The world's Orla Barry. Thanks a lot, Orla.
Thanks, Carol.
Europe is grappling with a lot more than just a stimulus package. There's also been a rise in far-right extremism. Germany prides itself on taking a tough stance against this, especially neo-Nazi ideology. In Berlin alone, more than 36 memorials and museums are dedicated to remembering the atrocities of World War II. But now, Germany is battling a rise in right-wing nationalism, including in the highest ranks of its own military. Luisa Beck reports from Berlin.
Earlier this month, Germany's defense minister, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, made a startling announcement. She was disbanding a company of Germany's most secretive and elite military unit, the KSK, because it was filled with far-right extremists. She described a troubling pattern.
Das ist abgeleitet aus einem ungesunden Eliteverständnis einzelner Führungskräfte.
There's an unhealthy elitism among some leaders in the KSK, which has fostered and developed a toxic leadership, extremist tendencies, and an absolutely unacceptable handling of weapons and ammunition in parts of the KSK.
The defense minister reported 48,000 rounds of ammunition and about 135 pounds of explosives were missing from the KSK, which are also known as special forces. And it's unclear whether they were stolen or missing because of sloppy bookkeeping.
I can say today that we can't rule out any of these possibilities. We have to consider everything.
The special forces have gotten a lot of media attention lately. In May, police commandos found Nazi songbooks, stickers, and magazines in the home of a sergeant major. They also discovered explosives, ammunition, and weapons that had likely been stolen from the German military. In recent years, former soldiers and other eyewitnesses have been coming forward with more stories about extremism in the KSK. In a 2017 interview with German public television, a woman reported attending a secret KSK celebration. She saw members do the Hitler salute and heard them play neo-Nazi rock songs. The woman, whose voice was altered to protect her identity, said she'd been flown into the celebration as a prize for one of the colonels.
Ich wurde dann um das Feuer getragen.
I was carried around the fire, was let down in front of the colonel. From there, I was supposed to bring him to a tent that had been prepared for us and where I was supposed to have sex with him.
The woman said that the colonel's hands were bloody because he just completed an obstacle course that involved tossing around a pig's head. She said he wound up getting too drunk to have sex. After the event, the woman reported what she saw to the German broadcaster ARD. They tried to verify the details of her report.
Nicht so leicht, denn andere Zeugen schweigen.
It wasn't easy because other eyewitnesses kept silent. Finally, we asked the German military, and to our surprise, they confirmed some parts of her story and are still investigating others.
The colonel himself objected to the woman's allegations. Although military counterintelligence kept an eye on him after the reports came out, he was promoted to one of the highest officer ranks in the KSK, according to reporting by the New York Times. The problem of far-right extremism within German security institutions isn't new. Between 2000 and 2007, a terrorist group called the Nationalist Socialist Underground killed a total of 9 immigrants, among others. One of the group's members was a former soldier. It took over a decade for the government to identify and start investigating the perpetrators. Experts say the problem got worse again after 2015. That was the year Chancellor Angela Merkel kept the German borders open and allowed over 1 million refugees and migrants fleeing war and poverty to enter the country. Many of them were from the Middle East.
Tired, bewildered children going from treacherous seas and crowded trains to being handed sweets and toys.
Public concern is growing about the high number of refugees and migrants arriving in Germany. And there's growing pressure too on the Chancellor. Angela Merkel, though, continues to insist her country can manage.
The far-right party Alternative for Germany started to gain power and helped fuel racist hate speech against Muslims, Jews and foreigners, which spread across the internet and into public discourse. This winter, a far-right terrorist shot dead 9 immigrants and German descendants of immigrants in the western city of Hanau. In a speech following the attack, Chancellor Merkel called racism and hatred a poison and condemned the attacks.
Heute ist ein überaus trauriger Tag für unser Land.
Today is a very sad day for our country. The deep pain felt by people in Hanau today over the violent death of so many fellow citizens is a pain I also feel personally and a pain felt by the entire country.
Germany has previously called far-right extremists bad apples in its otherwise democratic institutions. But in 2019, they committed more than 22,300 crimes. That's 10% more than the previous year. The growing presence of white supremacists in the military, though, is what has German authorities especially worried. Eva Höge, the German Parliament's Commissioner for Defense, said the rise of racist nationalism in the military hasn't been getting the attention it needs.
It was trivialized. It wasn't taken seriously enough. Now that such serious cases have been revealed and people investigated, I think it's clear to everyone that we have a problem with right-wing extremism and that it must be tackled as soon as possible.
Earlier this month, German military authorities said the special forces would be overhauled and that 600 German soldiers and 20 KSK commandos are being investigated for far-right extremism. How far their networks reach into the rest of the military, the police, and society is still unknown. For The World, I'm Luisa Beck in Berlin.
Shame is a powerful emotion. It can make you defensive or prompt you to face up to things and take action. For Thomas Kramer, it was the latter. Kramer is German and grew up feeling deeply ashamed of his country's Nazi past and responsibility for the Holocaust. He also wondered what on earth his grandparents and their generation could have been thinking. That sense of shame led him to an academic career focused on racial attitudes and what a country and its people need to do to confront their history. Kramer teaches public policy at the University of Connecticut. Thomas Kramer, your experience growing up in Germany really affected you, but I want to talk about American history. You support reparations for the descendants of those who were enslaved in the United States. Why do you think reparations are so important?
Well, I think it's an important symbol for, if you give an apology to show that you actually mean what you're saying, It's always symbolic because, you know, the term reparations is kind of a misnomer. There's nothing to be repaired. The lives that are gone, and freedom can't be bestowed retrospectively. But what you can do is repair the relationship between the descendants of the perpetrators and the descendants of the victims by apologizing and attaching a material symbol that expresses your sincerity.
So it sounds like you see reparations as much an important gesture for the descendants of the oppressors to make as a financial kind of payback or something for the descendants of those who were oppressed. Is that correct?
That's correct. When I was young, growing up, being confronted with the history of the Holocaust in every single school subject, I felt, like you said, ashamed of it. And I always dreamed of being able to express to a Holocaust survivor how I felt. Then one day, a Israeli family moved to my hometown in their retirement, of all places, to Germany. And our families became friendly. And during one family dinner, Mieczu, the family father, started telling us about the horrific experiences of his youth. He was interned in 5 concentration camps and subjected to a death march as a teenager. That was my opportunity to express to him how ashamed I felt. And he, in response, just embraced me and treated me like a son afterwards. And it's after he passed away, unfortunately, in 2015, that I learned from his widow that he had received a reparations pension since the 1970s from the West German government. And what I'm thinking may be possible that it served to him as a symbol that Germany meant what it was saying, and that Germany was trying to change its ways. And to me, it was a symbol that my country was taking responsibility and trying to make amends, which was psychologically important for me as well.
Germany is famous for teaching its school children about their country's past and responsibility for the Holocaust. You've lived in the United States for about 20 years. Do you think Americans have a national consensus about the impact and legacy of slavery?
Well, there is a very absurd consensus that had emerged in the 1920s under the Wilson administration, where basically the Civil War was whitewashed and the history of slavery and the conflict of slavery was written out of history. And instead, the war was presented as a war among the states. And the Lost Cause myth was produced, and everywhere across the southern states, Confederate, and not only the southern states, Confederate memorials went up.
I think Germany has a number of kind of national monuments about the Holocaust, about the Nazi period. Do you think it's significant that the United States has no real national museum or monument about slavery and its role in American history?
Absolutely. Especially before the African American Museum was built in Washington, D.C., there was nothing at all. And I always felt the Thomas Jefferson Memorial would be a prime site that you could convert into a slavery museum because of his conflicted views on the matter. On the one hand, proclaiming all men are created equal, and on the other hand, never freeing his slaves. I definitely think there should be a memorial for slavery in the Capitol. There is a Holocaust memorial in Washington, D.C., but not a slavery memorial.
Finally, I'm just curious, when you would ask your parents and grandparents about the Nazi period and the Holocaust, what would they say to you?
That's a very interesting question. Well, my parents, and I only knew my grandmother. So my parents' grandmother was silent on the issue. After my grandfather's sister passed away, I found in a bookshelf behind a set of biographies of conservative West German politicians, I found a whole stack of books from the Nazi era, including Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler and other things. She had kept those things. So that shows me that on her side of the family, there was a lot of sympathizing with the Nazi movement and just dealing by not addressing it. With my grandmother on my mother's side, they disliked the Nazi movement, but they never spoke up. And I loved my maternal grandmother very much. And I asked her, well, why did you not speak up? And she had tears in her eyes. And she told me, you know, we didn't know. And she told this to me with sincerity. And I wanted to believe her. Passers-by must have seen what was going on. The Nazis were not trying to hide it. They didn't advertise it on the front pages of their newspapers. But word of mouth must have reached the population in Germany. So I did not believe my grandmother as much as I wanted to believe her. It was very painful.
Thomas Kramer teaches public policy at the University of Connecticut. I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
For many of us, going to the movies means going into our living rooms and streaming something at home, or maybe hitting up a drive-in. But in parts of China, people bought tickets and went inside actual theaters today for the first time since the pandemic began. And this may surprise you, the number one film today in China was not a Hollywood action film. Rebecca Canther is on the line from Shanghai. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi there.
So I understand you went to the movies today.
I did. I happen to live next door to a movie theater, so it was very easy for me to drop by.
So I know you went to see the movie that we just heard a little bit from, A First Farewell, and I know, interestingly, it's about Uyghurs. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, there's many unusual things about this film and why it was the top seller. Number one, it's more of like an art film, not a documentary, but it feels like it. It's a very beautifully shot movie about three Uyghur children who are trying to learn Mandarin and sort of make their way through life.
It's interesting to me that there is a film in China about Uyghurs. Is there any whiff of it that's political?
No, this is not a very political movie. I mean, if you understand what is actually going on and, you know, the complexity of the situation in Xinjiang, then you can read into it. But it's mostly a movie about three children.
Rebecca, what other movies were playing?
So there were a lot of different options. There was a romance, there was a horror film, there was Coco for kids, and then there was Wolf Warrior, which is this hyper-nationalistic sort of sci-fi adventure film.
Was there anything else that struck you about the selection of movies?
So when I was looking for a movie to go to today, A First Farewell was the only relatively new film to be coming out. All the rest of the movies were old releases. And then I realized all of them are under 2 hours. And that's because there's a restriction that movies can only be under 2 hours long.
Is that a pandemic rule?
Yes, that's because of the pandemic. So apparently they need a time to disinfect every 2 hours.
Rebecca, what sort of restrictions were in place in the theater you went to?
When you walk in, you had to show your QR code, your green health code, to show that you are good to go to enter into buildings. You could not pay for a ticket at the counter. You had to go and do it all online. They took your temperature 2 times before entering. You had to provide your ID number and your phone number. And once you're in the theater, you're supposed to keep your mask on at all times. They kept capacity to 30%, and you're not supposed to sit next to other people, but people were breaking that rule all the time. So those were the basic things, and also there were no concessions. I noticed some people bringing in their own that they had bought outside, but the movie theaters were not selling any concessions.
Huh. And you mentioned a couple people kind of not observing the sitting guidelines. What about other things? Were people mostly observing the various restrictions?
I have to say, the one really nice thing about going to the movies today was almost everybody stayed off their phones, at least in terms of talking on their phones. Usually when I go to movies in China, people are talking on their phones throughout the movie, and this time it was pretty quiet.
The World's Rebecca Canther went to the movies for us in Shanghai. Thanks, Rebecca.
Oh, thank you.
Dolphins are fascinating animals. The way these mammals seem to communicate and the sounds they produce have been the focus of scientific studies and human curiosity for years. A sight of a dolphin pod in the ocean can be a highlight of a trip. Dolphins in captivity also attract curious tourists around the world. But how about robotic dolphins? Could they be an alternative to the flesh and bone animals in captivity? Entrepreneurs in New Zealand think so.
I am going to tell you about a magical place today. It's called the Oceanarium.
They are working with designers in the United States to develop animatronic dolphins that look almost identical to their living counterparts. The mechanical dolphins can respond to questions, swim happily in shopping mall display tanks, and get in close contact with humans. Roger Holzberg is one of the engineers involved in the design of the animatronic dolphin. He joins us from California. Roger, animatronic dolphins, robotic dolphins, do they look like the real thing?
They do. They look exactly like the real thing. Anatomically, they not only are the exact same size and weight of their adolescent Atlantic bottlenose dolphin counterpart. From the inside out, they've been engineered to mimic almost everything that a real dolphin does.
How do they work?
The first version 1.0 dolphin that we pilot tested with Walt Disney Imagineering when I was a vice president creative director there was animated by two animators who literally swam it with keystrokes from controls. The version 2.0 dolphin has a higher degree of artificial intelligence. The AI enables the dolphin to dive shallow depths, come back up, and simulate as though it's breathing. It enables it to maintain appropriate buoyancy in the water. It enables it to turn, complete turns, and swim normal behavior like that. But once it begins interaction, then the puppeteering takes over.
Having marine animals in captivity has come under scrutiny over the years. How are theme parks and aquariums reacting to the idea of having animatronic animals?
We did the pilot test for our Chinese partners right before the COVID pandemic struck. A month or so after that, we were in very active conversations with a major aquarium in the U.S., and we were going to do a long pilot with them this summer, integrating a robotic dolphin into their shark tank.
What are the challenges when you build new technology like this, and how do you fund it?
Edge Innovations, as a company, has been in business for 30 years.
Edge Innovations is the U.S.-based company building this dolphin.
That's correct. They did the orcas for Free Willy. They did the dolphins for the movie Flipper. They actually built part of the deep sea Challenger that James Cameron took down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. So their engineering expertise in marine animatronics has been around for about 30 years.
What's the price tag per animatronic animal versus what it would cost to care for a real dolphin?
That depends on the design and specification of what the robotic animal has to do. Over the course of a 10-year life cycle, the cost savings, when you look at the costs of live animals, transportation, veterinary, breeding programs, et cetera, versus their robotic counterpart, was in the tens of millions of dollars.
Roger Holzberg is one of the engineers involved in the design of the animatronic dolphin. He's been speaking to us from California. Thanks a lot, Roger.
You're welcome, Carol.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow for another spin of the globe.
From PRX.